Look through the window of the original Joe's on North Beach and you'll see two guys at the counter talking ball. Time for you to listen in to their conversation. Marty Lurie and the SF Chronicles' Bruce Jenkins are looking through the window of baseball. Sponsored by Original Joe's of North Beach and Westlake on KNBR 104.5 and 680, the sports leader.
All right, nice to have you back on this Saturday night. And as I was just talking to Raf, we can stay on later. So, Bruce, we got plenty of time to talk to Bruce and Kerry Crowley. We're going to hear from Tom Georgie of Georgie Brothers, Rich Waltz, former broadcaster for the Mariners, to talk about the great Mariner game with the Yankees. So we'll stay on later. You know, well, what's the big deal, right, Bruce? We can do this all night.
Yeah, well, the big rumors are going to have some of the flying Wallendas on later, which I'm going to be sticking around for that.
You know, it's so funny. You and I have done these shows, really, for probably 20 years. But this was one tonight, and I'm looking forward so much to talking to you about these things. This was one tonight that even I said, you know, I have to kick myself and pinch myself to keep asking questions because I'm just listening. You know, to Ron Wotus, Joey Malfitano, the third base coach in the 23-22 game. You know, yeah. Talking to, yeah, it's really, really
good. That is terrific, and I must apologize. I'm just now tuning in. I wasn't able to hear it. I'm sure I can call it up, but yeah, I'm glad it's been going so well.
Yeah, please do, and Raf will have it on the KMBR.com podcast page, but Wotus, Ron, and Bill Lasky and I, we did close to an hour, you know.
Very good.
Yeah, then that, and it took off after that, let's put it that way. But Joey Malfitano was amazing. But talking to you about some of these MLB games, and that's what I want to talk to you about tonight, the George Brett game, the Pine Tar game, just to see him come flying out of the dugout, and we've set it up tonight on the air. Two out in the ninth inning, UL Washington gets a hit. Gossage comes in, and it's the middle of the summer, and George Brett comes up and knocks one out, and Billy Martin just calmly walks out and says, by the way, would you please measure the bat for Pine Tar? I think there's too much. And after that, as they like to say with Leo DeRocher, all hell broke loose.
That's so Billy Martin, and I can really relate to it because I covered Billy when he first came to Oakland and was covering the Billy Ball A's, and I'll never forget a game in Seattle when he had a strong suspicion that Maury Wills, who was over his head managing the Seattle Mariners, liked to move the batter's box up a couple inches against a sinker baller, and the A's had Rick Langford going that night, and Billy Martin's watching. Only Billy Martin would do this. He's watching before the game, and it's like, sure as hell, they're moving the box up. So, but he doesn't do anything. He waits until, you know, the meeting at home plate where he can thoroughly embarrass Maury Wills. He brings it up. They're right. He cheated. And it's like, oh, my God. And so in the Brett case, Billy had a pretty strong suspicion that Brett used a lot of pine tar. But he's not going to bring it up at noon. You know, he waits till something big happens, and there's nothing bigger than Brett hitting a home run off Ritz Gossage to probably win the game. And all of a sudden, here he comes. He's got his arms folded. He's very calm. He's got a point to make. And next thing you know, Brett is called out, and I swear I've never seen a player quite so angry at an umpire. I can only imagine if he had an unimpeded path to Tim McClellan.
You know, it's funny, when Bill Lasky was on, we got to get Vida Blue on at some point. Vida was a Royal in those days. And according to Bill, Vida was sitting right next to Brett on the bench, and I've got to re-look at that.
I do too, yeah.
See if that was him. But you ended up seeing Brett do amazing things, and I think that's think we underestimate him, but, you know, the guy almost hit 400.
Yeah, to say that this is a defining moment of his career, I mean, I could forget it in a heartbeat. I mean, I was at Yankee Stadium at Game 3 of the 1980 ALCS when the Royals were on the verge of a sweep of the Yankees in the playoffs, you know, in New York against Gossage. Brett puts one in the upper deck. He homers into the upper deck, and the series is over. It's like, I'm just going to take this series from everybody in New York. There was a 1978, I think, he hit three homers in a playoff game again at Yankee Stadium, all off Catfish Hunter, one of them in the upper deck. the guy hit 390 one year. I mean, yeah, Brett is a god, and this is like a footnote for me.
Yeah, 390 that year.
390. Yeah. I was in the Royals clubhouse after that game, and Reggie Jackson comes in and goes. He comes right to Brett. He goes, first thing he says is, "How do you hit 390, man? How do you do that?"
I was right there. It was great. Yeah, so that was that game, and of course Lee McPhail correctly reverses the decision of Tim McClellan and the other umpires, and says the bat is okay. Then they have to resume the game. And Billy Martin's got Guidry in center field. And, you know, he's got the pitchers all over the place because he didn't know what he'd have to do in the ninth inning. So he didn't want to use a player because he wanted to have that competitive advantage of platooning. How about that?
Yeah, and plus he just wanted to reveal that the whole thing is a farce. You know, just the idea of Guidry in center field, he had Mattingly at second base. George Frazier was pitching for the Yankees that night, and before he threw a pitch, he fired it over to first, and then he fired over to second because Brett hadn't touched the bases in this invisible homer. I mean, Brett, you know,
Yeah, that was funny. I forgot about that. And so now they have a whole new umpiring crew, right? And Billy knows this.
Yeah.
So Billy's going to protest to this umpiring crew that Brett missed the base. And the umpire pulls out a piece of paper, an affidavit from the other umpire. How about, when was the last time you saw that?
Well, he had everything but a subpoena. Well, Billy is the greatest in-game manager I ever saw, and I've been covering the game for a long time. Nobody touches him for noticing the little things, and the timing that he had was always. I guess maybe sometimes he had a few too many drinks before the game, especially if he'd been drinking with Mickey Mantle in Texas. But I tell you, the guy was an unbelievable study in baseball genius.
So Hall of Fame for him or not?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah. He won't make it. But I did get a chance to sit in on one committee when we elected Bobby Cox and Joe Torre and Tony La Russa, and that was all good. But I'd love to be on one with Billy, and I'd love to hear the arguments to the contrary. I'm sure they're, be all about him. He was a very nasty guy. Obviously, he could be a real bastard. But you talk about managing a baseball team, and it was time after time, Detroit and Texas and Oakland and the Yankees. For me, he's in, but I understand where people think, there's the character clause, and he certainly wasn't Cary Grant. Let's put it that way.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. If you could put Leo DeRocher in, you could put him in.
No, I know. Did you read Leo? What's DeRocher's book called? Nice Guys Finish Last.
Yes.
Oh my God,
exactly.
He just crushes people in there. Yeah. Absolutely slaughters them.
Yeah. If he could
even
be
Ernie
in,
Banks, I think.
No, if he could be in, Billy Martin can be in. Charlie Severa, who we love and passed away, last year. Charlie always say, because he was Billy's coach. He was the right hand man for Billy, and I've mentioned this on the air before. And Charlie said, Billy would get fired at 12 o'clock. I'd be fired at 12:05.
And they'd always be back somehow.
Yeah, until the Yankees. Charlie said that's enough.
Yeah, he was a smart guy. He got out when he could.
Yeah, he became a great scout and everything else, the great Charlie Severa. Well, the other game that I really enjoyed watching was the Mark Fidrich game. From 1976. And so who's doing, Warner Wolf, Bob Prince,
and I think Euchre. Yeah.
I think it was Euchre, Warner Wolf, and Bob Prince doing that
National
game.
TV.
It was a Monday night. It was a Monday night special game against the Yankees. And there's Mark Fidrich with 50,000 people at Tiger Stadium. So first of all, Tiger Stadium, unbelievable. And
well,
filled
best
up
park
for,
ever.
For this
when
guy.
You're there, if you were there, it was the best park you ever saw. I don't even hear about anything else.
Really? Then
oh,
why
God,
do you say
yes.
that? Why do you say
well,
that?
Well, the press box, it was deceiving because the press box was way, way up high and a little too far away, realistically. However, the radio booth where I spent a few innings with Bill King one year was so close to the plate and so bereft of barriers that you could literally be killed in there from foul balls hit straight back. But the most important thing about Tiger Stadium was the second deck, which, we don't have second decks like this anymore. It was so close to the field. I really felt it was the greatest seat, at least since 1970. These are the greatest seats ever in any ballpark because you really felt like you're in the game. It was to such a point, Marty, that one year I gave up my seat in the press box and asked the PR people to sell me a ticket in the first row of the second deck of Tiger Stadium. I've never been any happier in my life.
Wow. What about the overhang? Talk about that in right field.
Great. I mean, the great thing about upper decks is that, well, they were upper decks, and what did them in was, you know, there's always columns here and there, and some people kind of can't see the field, which is a little bit of a drag.
Yeah.
But, you know, basically, you know, the look of the ballpark, the vantage points the fans have, even if they're out there, is so great. You know, the overhang was fantastic, and there was, every now and then someone would hit one up on the roof like a Reggie Jackson or Cecil Fielder, and it was like this mythical event, you know, even more impressive than hitting one in the Bay, far more impressive, really. And it just felt like baseball, and everybody that worked there that I ever came in contact with had this tremendous sense of pride of working at Tiger Stadium, and it was absolutely. And I've heard many people say this. Then you get to Fenway and you feel the same, right? You get to the old Yankee Stadium, you feel it again in Wrigley Field, but the Tiger Stadium was definitely one of those. And you know, the thing about Fidrich, Marty. His first game he ever pitched, okay, he's a rookie in 1976, nobody knows who he is, was in Oakland in late April.
Correct.
And he comes in and faces one guy, it's Don Baylor in a close game. He faces one guy. Baylor singles in the winning run, game over, see you later. Claudel Washington scores and the A's win. That was his major league debut. He didn't pitch again for like 2 weeks, and then he pitched a real gem in Cleveland where he had a no-hitter for 7 innings. And like you say, by the time it got to June and he was on a roll, there's nothing quite like it.
He started the All-Star game.
He's making $16,000 a year, and he starts the All-Star game.
Come on, in 1976, and listening to the broadcast, I love the broadcast with those three guys. You know, Bob Prince is so droll. And,
yeah.
You know, Warner Wolf is excitable, and Euchre was just as funny as ever. And they were saying, because it's pre-All-Star game, they're saying, well, he's got to start he's got to be on the team. He's got to start it. And he ends up 1976, Bruce. The guy not only makes the All-Star team, he starts the All-Star game. How about that?
He goes 19-9 with 24 complete games, and nobody even has won today. 2.3 ERA. I mean, what a story. And he's out there, you know, talking to the ball and telling the ball what path it's going to take, and then getting down on his knees and manicuring the mound and leaping over the foul lines. And it's funny, I did watch a tape of that Yankee Stadium game, and when it was over, nobody had left. It's like 50,000 people in Detroit are just, they're loving this moment so much, they had no reason to go home, and they give him a curtain call. And he was really pretty, as showy as he was really pretty modest, and he couldn't believe they were doing that. And he finally came out, and once they got him out on the field, they wouldn't let him leave, and it turned into this big Fidrich party. It was so great. I mean, nobody watching this guy, if you'd be 8 years old or you don't know the game at all, how fun and different he was. And, you know, in a way, it's almost, I don't know if it was better, and he died way too young, but the fact that he was a little bit of a meteor makes it especially cool and historically significant, because it was something that if you were able to see it and enjoy it, it was very, very special.
Yeah, because the next year, the arm trouble, and eventually the rotator cuff, and he was finished. But I looked up the All-Star game just because he gave up a couple of runs, you know, right away. So, you know, here he is, first time in the big leagues. He's starting the All-Star game in Veterans Stadium. And, 63,974. And in Tiger Stadium, the guy's looking around at 50,000, and he's so excited. I mean, he was like a kid looking at it.
Yeah.
So here's the first inning. So Pete Rose, single. Steve Garvey, triple.
Oh, my God.
Joe Morgan, fly out to short right field. George Foster, ground out, and the run scores. And then Luzinski, foul fly. So that's his first inning. His second inning, he sort of puts it together a little bit more. Bench gets a base hit. Kingman fouls out, and then Dave Concepcion a base hit, and then Randy Jones. They let Randy Jones hit in the second inning. Randy Jones was going to pitch his game, so they let him hit, and it's a pass ball, and then he strikes out. And then he ends up getting Pete Rose in a ground ball back to the box. So those are his two innings. But
if you can get Pete Rose on a ground ball back to the box, that's saying something. That's so funny they let Randy Jones hit. I mean, the whole point is to get a pinch hitter up there for these guys whenever you can. But, you know, pitchers went three. The starters tended to go three innings back then. If not the next two guys would go three innings.
Yeah,
I mean, now it's a different guy every at bat.
No, it's true. So he was going to get his time in, and then I can't even read who came in next. But the All-Star. Listen to this lineup for the National League. So Pete Rose, Garvey, Joe Morgan, George Foster, Lozinski, Johnny Bench.
Oh my God!
Dave Kingman. How about Dave Kingman in right? Concepcion and Randy Jones. So the American League. Ron LaFleur, who was in the game that you talked about.
Yeah.
Rod Carew, George Brett, Thurman Munson, Freddie Lynn, Toby Harrah, Rusty Staub, and Bobby Grich, and then Fidrich.
Unbelievable. Yeah, Rusty Staub was trying to get Fidrich to come out for that curtain call in that big game against the Yankees, and Fidrich is like, no, you go out there. He goes, Mark, I don't think they're crying for Mark and Rusty. I think it's just you.
Yeah, that was a great Bruce, I'll tell you, that 76 season, and this is why baseball does this and why MLB is doing it, especially at this time, to take our mind off everything and give us entertainment. Mark Fidrich, the bird, did just what you said. He would pat down the mound so he would land in the same spot that he wanted.
Yeah,
he talked to the ball. He talked to himself. He captured the entire baseball world for that whole season. Every time.
He had this guy on. Yeah, it wasn't an act. I mean, this is what he did. He was a country guy from the farm in Massachusetts, and, you know, he's talking about, I'm not really that smart, you know. had the great accent, and he's just this guy. You know, he was an absolute original, but he was not a fake. He wasn't trying to put on an act. This is what he did when he pitched. You know, he wanted to tell the ball what was happening and have a discussion with the ball. Really, with any luck, the ball would have a few things back to say to him. And this is how he went about it. And meanwhile, he got all these guys out. And you know, there every season is great in baseball, but some of the hitters that he faced, and you just mentioned there, and he got them out all season, a 19-game winner.
Mm. And this was a fiction story coming to life.
And, it really was.
And we've never seen it again.
Or really anything close. I mean, you can talk about Al Raboski having a moment behind the mound, and then he storms back to the mound. He's going to war against Braveheart or something. But there was nothing like Fidrich.
No, very good. 19-9, 1976. Yeah. Wow. 250 innings. And he walked 53, struck out only 97. How about that?
Well, that's cool because he was clever. He was a little bit of Greg Maddux in him. He moved the ball around. Yeah. He had guys hitting what they weren't expecting. And, you know, the timing is so important. And I think that's a great part of his story. And it makes you think that if he's stayed healthy, he could have done that a few more years.
Right, very good. All right, those are the Pine Tar game we got with George Brett, and we got the Fidrich game. We had Joey Malfitano on for about 45 minutes talking about the 23-22 game in Wrigley Field, where Joey was the third base coach for the Cubs.
and he had to ice down his arm afterward.
Well, the first inning, Philly scores 7 in the top of the first. Randy Lurch, it's a home run, the pitcher, and he doesn't make it out of the first. In the bottom of the first, he gives up 6.
The Phillies were up 21-9 in that game.
That's correct.
And they barely hung on to win. Larry Boas said, yeah, we're up 12, and if we can just hold them under a couple of touchdowns, we might be all right, you know.
Five hits for him in the game.
Yeah,
and, that's
great.
And the other one is Dave Kingman. You know, he had 3 home runs in the game, and Joey said, look, and Joey was very candid about it. He said, you know, the guy didn't always give you, he would give you 50 cents on the dollar, so to speak. He said, if he would have put this his mind to this, he would have been one of the great players.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure Tug McGraw never got over it. He gave up 7 runs in a third of an inning. It took him the rest of the year to get his ERA back. But what I loved about that is read about it. You know, we're all in retrospect here, but it came down to Mike Schmidt, and the guy on the mound was Bruce Sutter, who was probably the best reliever. He was throwing the split finger, and at that time it was like this revolutionary pitch that nobody could hit, and I'm not sure what he threw it. I think it might have been a split, and in the top of the 10th, and Schmidt put it in the bleachers, and that was the game-deciding run. But, yeah, Schmidt, Sutter, and Pete Rose, Bill Buckner, Gary Maddox was in that game. Donnie Moore was in that game, and it's pretty stunning to behold.
Well, you and I have talked for years about Pete Rose and going back and forth on this Hall of Fame stuff. Bruce, after watching him play in this game and remembering how he played, and he ended up with, 3 or 4 hits, I think, I forget how many hits he was. He was 3 for 7 and scored 4 runs. After the third out, he would spike the ball at first base. But to see that batting stance, the way he was hunched over, choking up on the bat, you couldn't get the ball past him. And I'm trying to think of somebody, Rod Carew maybe, someone like him, and there's no doubt in my mind. And for me not to have him as a Hall of Famer, he'd have to open up a bookie shop in the middle of Market Street. Honestly.
Yeah.
And he's like Trump.
Yeah, exactly.
Trump would have to shoot somebody on Broadway.
The way things are going.
Nobody would care. But guy, for some reason, people care. But as a baseball player, I just can't think of anybody close to the guy.
No. So, sometimes we sit around dreaming up our all-time team. We're going to take on, I'm going to pick my team and see if you can beat it or vice versa. And, you don't know where to put Pete in the field, maybe at third or left field, but I'm going to lead off with Rose because when he steps up there, the other team's going, okay, we're really in it for it now. It's not like Carew or Tony Gwynn. When he got in there, he owned the plate, he owned the game, he owned the county, the city, and the state. I mean, he was just a friggin' badass guy up there, and you could just tell he was gonna have a good night. One time I had the privilege of being in Cincinnati during the end of his career, and he just went 5 for 5 against the Giants. I'm just thinking, God, this guy's just insane. And you mentioned the Hall of Fame. I've had a vote for a long time, since 1990. And once it became evident that he wasn't going to get in or even be on the ballot, I wrote in his name like 2 or 3 years. And finally, the BBWA gave me a stern warning, not to do this anymore. But I was really happy that I did because, good Lord, is he a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. To exclude him for what he did on the baseball field is ridiculous. Because people don't, you had to watch this game to remember him, because we don't have that that remembrance at the Hall of Fame.
And it's
took
so
this
simple,
game
Marty.
For me to, it took this game for me to think back.
Yeah.
44 game hitting streak, and he ends up grounding out the last of the Gene Garber, throws him some sort of change up, and I was so disappointed when the
I haven't forgiven Garber for that to this day. But you mentioned the Hall of Fame. I mean, it's so easy, Marty, with whether it's Rose or Barry Bonds or Clemens, just, give him the plaque, get him in, and on the plaque make it very clear that this was a rogue. This is not a good guy. But you can't tell the story of baseball without him. I know that.
No, you cannot. No. So that was a pretty good one to see that game. I enjoyed that. And I guess maybe our last thing with Wotus and Bill Lasky, we went back to 2010 to the Giants World Series. And Woe brought it up. He said, look, Sandoval was struggling. We couldn't put him in there. So Uribe played third and, of course, had the tremendous home run. Against Texas, and then Renteria was the shortstop. How about that for your left side of the infield? You forget about that.
You really do. You forget about those guys. You forget about Freddie Sanchez and Cody Ross and Pat Burrell. It seems so long ago, given what they did after that, where the fresher memories are more solid in your mind. But it was just so amazing how they just took over that postseason. Matt Cain being such a huge part of it, but they just steamrolled people. It's like all of a sudden this is the best team, and there's just really no question. I mean, by the time Brian Wilson, you know, polished off that final strikeout in Texas, it was just like, okay, we've seen this coming for a couple of weeks now, and why not? And I know you've been talking about Kane. It's funny because he had a, what was his postseason ERA? Was 2.10, right?
Come on, it was something. It was like 0.21 for a while.
Yeah, somebody I'm sure would say, well, yeah, but Bumgarner would beat that, but he actually didn't. Bumgarner was 2.11. I love that. 2.10, 2.11. You want to know why they won it? How about those two guys?
Well,
that
until,
was 16 games for Bumgarner.
Well, that's what Woe said. Woe said our pitching, because I said, you know, what'd you think going into Texas? And he said, well, when we knocked Philly out, we knew we had the pitching. And whether it was Lincecum, Kane, Bumgarner, Jonathan Sanchez, and he said then we had the bullpen. And we felt
when they,
good
when they
about
beat Philadelphia, which nobody thought they were going to beat the Phillies, and when they did that, the sense of confidence and self-assurance that they had, I've heard Kruko and Kuiper talk about how the guys were so just unbelievably jacked up. They just felt like they were invincible, and they really were. It was in that special period of time. You could have put anybody against him in the World Series, and they would have been fine.
Well, Woe said Lincecum was just unbelievable. And that's, he had the Atlanta game, remember, that may be his best game to start the playoffs.
Oh,
and he said Lincecum and Lee in game five was nothing until the seventh inning. and don't forget Huff, that's where Huff bunted and got the runner, you know, and then Renteria hit the ball, and, you know, those are the three runs.
Yeah, it's great, and I think they've been showing some 2010 stuff on NBC Sports Bay Area. You know, they certainly have the capability to do it, and they should. I know they did 2012. Might have been today, but you know, fans should be aware of checking the listings for NBC Sports Bay Area, because they're calling up some great Giant stuff.
Yeah.
And when you really don't have anything to do, if you're one of these people who is really cast to stay at home and everything's kind of gone dry, I mean, you can watch that game and get lost in a really good memory.
Yep. It's good stuff. It's good stuff. And, you know, for 3 hours or 3.5 hours, I'm not thinking about anything other than this.
No.
And that's kind of what baseball does for you. So,
Yeah,
it's good. It's good stuff. Who knows where this is all going. But baseball does fill that void, that entertainment, like no other sport. And, look, I could say Emmanuel Sanders is now on New Orleans, and, you know, Gurley got released and this and that, and Brady's in Tampa Bay. But, but 5 years from now, you talk about baseball.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the NFL is providing a lot of sports talk, and, you know, whether it's ethically correct or not for them to be doing free agency, it is creating a lot of conversation. But I don't know, for me and you and a lot of our listeners and, you know, all the great guests you have on, it's just not quite the same as baseball. It's hard to explain why, but I think it's because it's just in your soul and in your blood all day long for months and months. And you look forward to it with, you know, such anticipation. And I don't know how much of it we're going to get, but whenever it comes back, it'll be just as great.
Yeah, and I'm glad to be able to do these kind of shows and have you on. And, you know, I think it means a lot to the fans. I've gotten nice texts and emails and tweets and all that kind of stuff. I know you have, too. I follow your timeline, and people are, you know, so appreciative of what you do. Ken Korak was on earlier. I asked, and you've done these lists and all that stuff this week. Of your first favorite baseball player. So Korak was on and said, look, I lived in L.A., but for me, it was in Anaheim, and it was Jim Fregosi.
That
was my favorite baseball player. How about for you?
I think Henry Shulman said the same thing.
Really?
Following his Twitter. But for me, well, we're going back to 1958 now, and the Giants and the Dodgers had moved west, and my dad, who lived in New York prior to that in the 50s in the music business, is all over that team. And, you know, they brought out Duke Snider and Carl Farrillo and Pee Wee Reese, Johnny Padres, Carl Erskine and Don Newcomb, and they had a lot of guys who had been big stars in Brooklyn who were kind of past it. But for me, the guy was Gil Hodges. And I think the reason was my dad told me about him. He said, this is a great man. He's very humble. And my dad had enough pull to where I was able to meet Gil Hodges on the field before a game against probably the Braves, as we always went to see the Milwaukee Braves for some reason. And I got to shake Gil Hodges' hand, and my little 10-year-old hand vanished in this massive continent of a hand of Gil Hodges. And I just never forgot that, and I started paying really close attention to him. Even then, he was one of the great artists of defensive first base, and he'd hit home runs. And he was definitely my guy. Not too long after that, it became Hank Aaron, and Hank was my guy for until he became really popular, chasing Babe Ruth, and then everybody liked him. But then Hank was my number two guy.
Ah, very good, Gil Hodges. Gene Bogato from the Tides Wharf up in Bodega Bay, and of course a great baseball fan, has been texting me. You probably hear it going off in the background here. And he said that baseball is a soul. That's what it is. Baseball is part of our soul, is what he said. And his other comment was, Rose should have his plaque. Did he ever have a slump? And he said the last line of the plaque should be received lifetime ban from baseball for gambling in 1989. And his last comment was that Gene's dad knew Frank Crosetti, and Larson didn't know for sure that he was going to pitch until he got to the ballpark, and Crosetti put the ball in Larson's shoe. And that's how Larson knew that he was going to pitch. But I think he did know because Arthur Richman, I remember Arthur Richman?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, I had him on the show, and he said that he took Larson out the night before. And he made sure he didn't drink, allegedly. So that's,
which for Larson, he only had 5 vodkas that night. It was great. tremendous show of restraint.
Okay. Last Gil Hodges story. Mark Ellis, when he went to the Dodgers, wore number 14. And I said to Mark, I said, God, you're wearing number 14. He says, oh, yeah, it's Mike Socha's number. And I said, Mark, I want to tell you something.
Yeah.
It's Gil Hodges.
It's funny because when I got, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. When I got into Little League, I said, is there any way I can wear 14? And I got to wear 14. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm Gil Hodges out here. Yeah. That's where the comparison ended, but it was fun.
Well, I said that to Mark Ellis. And, of course, he had no idea who I was talking about. But I said, you're wearing 14. And Jock Peterson still wears 31. And that's he's a Jewish ball player. Number 31 was the Dodgers' first base coach, Jake Pitler.
And he
wore 31, and that's why I still believe that's why Jock Peterson got 31. So
how about that? That's terrific.
Yeah. Little things you learn on a Saturday night.
I'll tell you, Marty, you're keeping it going. You're keeping the flames burning, and I'm sure your audience is. I mean, you've had so many great people on, and it's going to continue. And it's very important. It's very, very important at this time that we're in.
Well, thank you. All right, we'll talk next week, and have a great week, and we'll follow everything you do. And we're just lucky that we have baseball. So do your best.
Thank you, Marty. You too.
Okay. All right, that is the wonderful Bruce Jenkins. All right.